Did you know that the 4th of July is on a Thursday this year? That's going to be a full weekend of fun out on the deck, 4 days. But if your deck isn't what it used to be and you aren't using it for great family gatherings, you need to call my friends at All Weather Decks. All Weather Decks is a 24-time winner of the Angie Super Service Award. And they probably help one of your neighbors. Click on the map link at allweatherdecks.net. Call All Weather Decks today at 913-206-1974 or go to allweatherdecks.net and mention you heard it on 810. Call now and relax.
Pack your bags, start the car, and get on the road. It's time to go across the country, 2 minutes at a time, for the biggest stories of the day, where they're happening.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Indianapolis, Indiana.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Cleveland, Ohio.
Boston, Mass.
Miami, Florida.
It's the 2 Minute Drill on the program.
Second half of the program begins right now, around the country, 2 minutes at a time. Talking to the people, covering the stories where they are happening. We'll start things off in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Brian D., ESPN 94.5, is there. Brian, how are you, sir?
I'm well. Thanks for having me again.
The Bucks, first team to clinch with 55 days left in the season. That's a record. What do they do with the rest of the season? Certainly, they'll want to secure the number one seed, but do they push to try to win 70?
Yeah, you know, I think the overarching goal for the Bucks over the next 26 games, it sounds basic and cliche, and it's a platitude, but it's to continue to improve and to continue to get better. You know, going back to last season, they were dominant, just like they are right now, all the way through Game 2 of the Eastern Conference Finals when they took a 2-0 lead over Toronto. And at that point, things fell apart, and Kawhi Leonard became the best player in that series, and obviously the Raptors ended up winning the championship. So that is still stuck very much in the head of Giannis Antetokounmpo and really the entire Bucks organization. So as crazy as it sounds, you know, they did break that record, earliest team to ever clinch in the NBA, which is unbelievable. They're 48-8. They're dominant again, but they found themselves in a very similar position at this point last season. They're by no means being complacent. By no means are they comfortable. They're going to continue to improve. Giannis even spoke earlier this week, sir, about adding a different shot to his game. He's working mid-season on adding a fadeaway mid-range jump shot in the lane to his game. So they are very much focused on improving. And, you know, if they start flirting with 70, they're a competitive group, and they're going to go after it with the tenacity that they feel they got disrespected. And I think to a certain extent, they're still feeling a little bit disrespected nationally.
And they should. I was driving home last night from doing something, and the conversation was that even though the Celtics lost to the Lakers, you know, they were questioning, are they now the best team in the East? Or because Kemba Walker's been ill or been out, or is it still the Bucks? I mean, even asking that question is an insult, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's nonsense. When you're 48-8 and you've been the top team in the East, you know, outside of that four-game stretch last season in the playoffs, I mean, the Bucks will never come out and say that, but you know, they'd be lying to you if they came out and said they didn't feel disrespected nationally. And what a great position for that organization to be in, where they can be the most dominant team in basketball and also play the underdog card, right? I mean, that's a dream for an organization. That's a dream for the fans in this city. Milwaukee's a small blue-collar town anyway, so to be able to play that card in addition to having the most dominant team in basketball and fly under the radar nationally a little bit, I think it's an ideal situation for Bucks fans and for that organization to be in.
All right, what's the reaction to the Brewers owner, Adanasio?
Adanasio, yeah.
Yeah, saying that, budget didn't have anything to do with them not signing anyone in the offseason. What's the reaction been?
Yeah, so he came out at the beginning of camp and said that the Brewers operated in the red last year, which is, you know, obviously something that is going to happen, you know, occasionally when you're an organization in a small market like Milwaukee. I'm sure you guys you know, have seen similar things in KC. What I think he was doing there, the Brewers, they built Miller Park in 1999, 2000, 2001 is when the stadium opened. And the stadium tax just sunset here in Milwaukee. There was some public money going into the stadium. I think if I were guessing what he was doing there, he's trying to paint a little bit of a sympathetic picture, knowing that that tax is sunsetting and maybe thinking he might ask the public for additional money at some point. I know it's getting really nitty-gritty into Milwaukee stuff there, but I don't know if his comments were as much about the team operating in the red, not spending money because of that in free agency as much as they were maybe positioning and politicking a little bit for some future money down the line, because the stadium is still in phenomenal shape up here in Milwaukee. If anybody gets an opportunity to come up from KC and wants to do a baseball road trip, man, what a great place to watch a ball game. But I think at some point down the line, the stadium's going to need to keep up and be renovated, like just to keep up with the times in terms of some of the great stadiums that are being built across Major League Baseball. So that's the way I took that comment from Matt Nacio anyway, is, hey, you know, we are a small market team. We didn't spend a ton of money in free agency because we were operating in the red last year. I think there were probably some ulterior motives there as opposed to just on the field stuff.
Did they even try? I mean, did they make a run and the price was too much, or did they just pretty much stand pat? Because if you stood pat, it was budget.
Yeah, they stood pat and didn't do a whole lot. I mean, you think about a former Royal and Mike Moustakas got paid big money by the Reds this offseason. Yasmani Grandal going down to Chicago. They just got priced out of some of those situations, and David Stearns feels comfortable, the president of baseball ops and GM, feels comfortable kind of playing the money ball game. You know, they've done it relatively successfully over the last couple of seasons in Milwaukee, getting contributions from some lower budget guys, and David Stearns decided to take that route. And you know, budget is going to be part of it as well. They don't have the luxury of paying Gerrit Cole money or even Yasmani Grandal money to some players, and that's the way that an organization like the Brewers has to operate. So yeah, budget's going to be a part of it for sure.
Brian D in Milwaukee, we appreciate it, buddy. Have a great week.
You bet.
It's a fact. The greatest city in the history of mankind. Discovered by the Germans in 1904, they named it San Diego.
Judson Richards in San Diego, Extra 1360, is up next. Judson, how are you, buddy?
Well, you really dedicated that one, aren't you, Saran?
We are. What other songs, what else do you have that they say San Diego?
Well, I don't know. I just keep waiting for you to mix it up a little bit.
No. There are no songs about San Diego. There are no movie quotes, but nothing takes place in San Diego.
Nothing.
This is it.
Nothing?
You've got one thing.
You're right. I was going to say that old Supercharger song. That wouldn't work.
No, that's not going to work right now. All right. by the way, is San Diego pissed that they're not in the XFL after being in the AAF?
A bit like, I don't know about you. I'm not much for going out to parties, but I do really like to be invited. So I think our feelings may have been hurt a little bit, but it turns out because we had Oliver Luck on my show the day before the XFL began on that Friday, and he made it clear. He said, listen, I love San Diego. We love the San Diego market. When we were going over what markets we want to go to, all of the dates were filled due to your AAF team. So we were kind of blocked by the San Diego Fleet, who were off and running by that other pro league that had a very short run. So I do think, because if you look at the turnout in St. Louis, I do think we would have had an XFL team. But because of the AAF, they didn't know what to play. That's the bottom line.
Well, all right, very good. San Diego State.
Are we missing out?
I don't know. I haven't decided yet. I'll let you know. I'll let you know when I come to a solid conclusion.
Okay, buddy.
San Diego State loses. You expected this to happen, but when you get this close, very disappointing. Is this going to be a good thing, though? You know, okay, now we can really get them to listen to what they need to work on to get better. Or no, just a big pisser because they don't get the undefeated season.
Well, on one side, before this game Saturday, they had beaten UNLV 16 of the last 17 times they played. The last four meetings at home previously to Saturday, they had averaged a 26-point margin of victory. So they had just blown the doors off the UNLV, however many years they've played. But on the other side of it, you know, as I said, we never expected them to be undefeated at this point when the season began because we literally had no expectations. Like, there was no preseason top 25. We're still kind of learning guys' names. The three big guys beside Matt Mitchell all transferred in and are playing together for the first time with Malachi Flynn, K.J. Fagan, and Yanni Wetzel. I mean, it is truly remarkable to see how well this team is playing with how few games they played before previously and the fact that no one was able to point at this team being in a top five in the country. The one thing that does kind of suck, Saran, is the Aztecs as a program, with as many great things they've accomplished, two Sweet 16 appearances in the last decade, they had never been above number four in the country. So number one goes down, number two goes down in Gonzaga. So I think there was a really great chance that the Aztecs would have been able to kind of check that box. But again, a 26-1. One was able to tell you that this was coming.
That was interesting. It was about a 4-second pause there in that
Thank
statement.
Which one?
I'm not sure what the deal is with your phone there, but
I'm in the mountains.
No, well, good. I'm glad for you. tell me, the Padres' expectations are what?
Well, my expectations are to win more than they've won since 2011, and the most they've won since 2011 are 77 games in a season. So can we get to 500? Can we get to 500 for a team that spent $500 million over the last three offseasons? You know, you got Eric Hosmer contract. You've got Manny Machado contract. You know, one of the best players in baseball in Fernando Tatis Jr. You got Chris Paddock, who was a great surprise. So the expectations to me, again, now the owner, one of the owners, Ron Fowler, did say, I'd like to see us above 500. So, Soren, we will take 82-80. That's how high we set the bar in San Diego. But, again, if you watch the team, which when was the last time they were in the playoffs? 2006, with a team that snuck in just over 500 because of a terrible NL West. Like, the bar is so low, but they almost just drag you into it and go, give me cold beer, great tacos, a beautiful ballpark, and let's aim for just over 500.
So, Fernando Tatis, was this the plan all along? Or, you know, him going to the outfield, or what? What was the point of having him at shortstop for a while if this was the plan?
Well, no. He's not going anywhere. He is not going anywhere. It started with the Francisco Lindor potential move to bring him in. And then they had conversations inside the building about whether or not Fernando Tatis Jr. would be better served to play center field because of how he's built. Soren, he is a huge man. I mean, he is a huge guy that just turned 21 that is still filling out. But as of now, Fernando Tatis Jr., as A.J. Preller said, he will not be playing anywhere but shortstop this spring.
At 6'3" and 210, is that where he's going to end up? I mean, Alex Rodriguez didn't stay at short.
I think he's bigger than that. You know, standing on carpet with him, I mean, he looked immediate. I thought he was somebody else. And his dad has even said, I think he's still got room to grow. So once he starts filling out, there's a good chance that he is too big to be a long-time shortstop. And if you watch his body, there's just so many arms and legs. It's just, you know, I mean, it's not just Omar Vizquel thing where it's very compact and the jumping and the spinning works. You know, they may keep him at shortstop just to try to keep him around long-term, which we know how difficult that's going to be with the money that he's going to demand. I mean, I think he can play wherever he wants if he's willing to be in this lineup for the next 4 to 6 to 8 to 10 years. But he may be best served potentially once he's 24, 25, 26 and he starts filling out potentially as a corner infielder or even as a center fielder because he is a tremendous athlete. But he is huge.
Judson, we'll let you get back to that hiking you're clearly doing right now. always appreciate the time, my friend. Have a great week.
Friend, you're the best, buddy.
I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans.
Gus Kattengill, ESPN 100.3 in New Orleans, Louisiana. Gus, how are you, buddy?
Man, I'm doing great. I feel for you, man. You got one guest out in the mountains hiking. I'm on Lundi Gras. Mardi Gras tomorrow for me. I mean, how's the studio?
Yeah, very nice. Very nice. All right, tell me, how much has Zion fever taken over New Orleans?
Dude, it took over months ago. And, you know, it hit that, obviously, that lull when he was injured and people were anxious, and I preached patience. I mean, dude, every day on the show, it was fire Gentry, blow everybody up, trade everybody. I'm like, Breeze, the guy hadn't played. You got to give them time. I wanted to see the team a month after he started to play. I don't think anybody expected the impact that he had. I mean, look, I wasn't one that didn't think he would translate into the NBA, whether it's lack of size or lack of three-point shooting. The guy is athletic, and athleticism translates to anything. But I think everyone's been surprised with, what is it now, 7 consecutive or 9 consecutive 20-point games. You're just seeing the growth and maturation. And I think what was interesting yesterday that really is going to get Zion Mania going is you're just seeing the natural order of things take place. Brandon Ingram, because of Zion's injury, had to put the team on his back and lead the team in scoring and really be the team's leader. Drew Holiday just hadn't really gotten to that point, right? But what you're seeing now is Zion taking over. Yesterday, reaming the team out at halftime, leading by example. Drew Holiday after the game saying, look, we had to pay attention because he was out there busting his butt, and we were losing at halftime by 10 at Golden State. So I think being 19, from what I talked to people on the team, it took him a little bit to kind of, you know, assert himself and find that place and understand that he is the best player on that team. But it's hard to just walk in there and start demanding things from players and stuff if you hadn't done anything. I think now you're seeing them on the court. Now you're seeing them dominating the court. Now you're seeing them take games over. And yesterday, now you're seeing them take the locker room over. That like gives me the goosebumps because you're just seeing it progress naturally. And you know, the kid's 19. It's incredible.
They're just 3.5 games out of that last playoff spot. We'll see if they can run that down and get there. Drew Brees is back. That's what you said you thought would happen. Now what do they do around him to try to finally break back into the Super Bowl?
Yeah, they got a ton of questions, man. It's going to be a busy couple of weeks here, and you have to kind of start putting plans A, B, and C together and find out where you're going to go. And it's so funny, and I think fans are so used to, because of salary caps in the past, even though Mickey Loomis has done a great job, the same general manager, not even making it seem like it affects this team. They always find ways to get players, to sign players, what have you. But over here, man, it's incredible. People want Drew Brees to play like for $10 million because they fear that's the only way this team can spend in free agency, pay Marshawn Lattimore, pay Ryan Ramczyk, pay an offensive guard or something, or find one if Andres Pete, they decide not to pay him. You got Alvin Kamara that's hinted at holding out. And I've heard numbers that are ridiculous, like 13 to 15. And, you know, you look at it, and if he plays for 22, that is a heck of a discount. He was making 25 and 27 the last 2 years. So he's not going to play for 10. He shouldn't pay for 10. Salary cap goes up. He's going to be fine. That's not going to kill you. It's trying to decide what and who you should pay moving forward. That is going to be the big decision. So I mentioned Kamara. Sean Payton during Super Bowl week mentioned a goal of theirs is to extend Ryan Ramczyk, the right tackle. He gave up 0 sacks all last season. So, and Lattimore's coming up here as well. What do you do with Andres Pete, the left guard? Teron Armstead's great at left tackle when he's healthy. He hadn't finished the season. He hadn't played most of the season. So they got some huge, huge decisions to make. Von Bell, their strong safety, I think is probably the biggest free agent you have to re-sign. So they have a lot of decisions to make, man.
Tell me, Joe Burrow, 9-inch hands. People are making a thing of this. Should there be a thing made of Joe Burrow's hand size?
I understand the hunger for football talk and things of that nature. I promise you, get me to April or get me the free agency stuff. Like I'm talking about like the guys are coming out of the draft. I call it the Philly season. People will find things and forget what their eyeballs show them, right? If you tell me that his hands can't throw a football, what did you see in college? The guy was one of the most accurate passers in college football. Did you ever see a wobble on an out pass? Did you ever see him lose grip of the football in fumble? Did he have that problem? Ever fumbling? Never. Now all of a sudden is his hand. People are going to find things because that's what they're doing right now. And look, I trust my eyes. I trust body of work. It's the phrase I use on our show all the time. If you see things that are continuous or consistent, that are positive, chances are they're going to be positive. If you see a quarterback that throws the football, you know, to the other team, has trouble with fumbles, has trouble reading defenses, makes poor decisions, chances are at the next level when the game is faster, that's going to happen. I didn't see that. So I've never, ever, ever heard that he had an issue with his hand size or grip strength or anything from that nature. So, again, I just, whatever. Believe me, I would love for him to not get taken all the way to 24 for the New Orleans Saints, because every day on the show, we come up with reasons why the Bengals should not draft Joe Burrow.
Well, and there's the potential that, at least there's talk that he might pull an Eli Manning. Do you have any reason to believe that that's what he would do?
No, I don't. I think what you're seeing is one of the things, more than anything, is I think when the whole leverage thing that he was saying and things of that nature, I think it's brilliant and it's smart, right? Because now you force the other team to kind of get their stuff together. And the analogy I keep using is the Pelicans. You lost Anthony Davis. Management and ownership had to look at themselves and say, okay, what are we going to do? Are we going to be the same franchise? What, you know, let's ask, why do people view us a certain way? And I think it's smart on his part to sit in the room when he's going to get interviewed, obviously, this week at the Combine and say, okay, my question would be, you know, reverse interview. Why haven't you won a playoff game? Why didn't Andy Dalton win a playoff game? You wasn't bad. It's good during a regular season. Why didn't y'all win in the postseason? Why can't y'all win a playoff game? Why don't you have an indoor practice facility? What's the issue? It forces the other team and the ownership to say, okay, look, we need to pick up our game here as well. So I don't ever think, man, from what I gathered, that he's that type of person that that would just, like, select where he wants to go and not do it. It's his home state. I have a hard time buying that he would pull one of those moves like Elway and Manning and go play in another franchise.
Gus Kattengill in New Orleans. Great stuff, buddy. We appreciate it. Have a great week.
Always a pleasure, man. Thank you.
Pete Fox, NBC Sports Radio in Los Angeles, California. Pete, how are you?
Hey, doing good, man.
The Kobe Bryant Memorial today, 80,000 requested tickets. They held a lottery for the 20,000 seats. I'm assuming there was probably 2 or 3 or 4,000, you know, dignitaries, for lack of a better term, fellow NBA players, teammates, and so on. What did you take away from the memorial?
Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey.
Yeah.
Trying to find a good spot.
That's all right. What did you take away from today's Kobe Bryant memorial?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that the rest of the league has kind of participated in this memorial remembrance, celebration of life. You know, like they played the Celtics yesterday, and the Celtics stayed over and went to the event today. So a lot of guys, as you mentioned, have come from other teams, asked for personal time off to participate in this event. And I think that's the biggest thing. I mean, Celtics and Lakers are the biggest rivalry in basketball. And you saw Celtic guys wearing Kobe Bryant number 24 and number 8 wristbands yesterday during the game. So I think those are the kind of thoughts that you take away from this event going, wow, I mean, we knew that he meant a lot, but even still, you see this kind of thing continue to be an issue for people. Not an issue, but, you know, it's continuing to impact people and be hard for people to deal with, and people are making statements, you know, still here over a month after the tragedy.
No, I think you're still there, Pete. And the Lakers get the win against Boston. You mentioned it being an event. It has not been a distraction, though, for the Lakers at all, right?
It wasn't really, no. I mean, the biggest one was against Portland, you know, like after the first game after. They were pretty out of sorts in that game. So I feel like they've kind of figured out how to deal with it to a certain extent. Definitely not easy, but something that obviously they're getting a little bit more comfortable with dealing with, how to switch on the attitude of we're going to go into this situation and deal with our grief, and then when it's over, we're going to switch it off and we're going to go back to being basketball players. So that's the toughest part for them, is knowing how to deal with it and how to, you know, just accept the grief and then move on.
Clippers have lost 3 in a row. Do they have a problem, or are they just waiting to flip a switch come postseason?
Yeah, it's interesting. We talked about it before, and I think it's still the issue that they are trying to find camaraderie and cohesion among all of these guys, you know, with all of the rest for Kawhi and injuries for guys like Patrick Beverley. They still haven't really gotten on the same page together. I heard an interesting discussion today about it, that last year the Clippers were just grinders. They were going after it, you know, every game, every night, trying to prove that they were a legitimate basketball team, and they did that. And then they get Kawhi Leonard and Paul George, and, you know, everyone thinks it's going to be a little bit easier, and you can't help if you're one of the players on the Clippers that you're going to fall into that mindset that, hey, we've got Kawhi and we've got PG, and we don't really need to play hard every single night. And then you look at the fact that Kawhi Leonard looks at the regular season as, a throwaway. It's not that big of a deal. So I feel like the Clippers are falling into that getting lackadaisical mentality mindset when they weren't that team last year because of the acquisitions of these big-time free agents this year. So we'll have to see how it goes in the postseason when they have to flip the switch on. It's obviously going to be a different situation, but you just don't know if they can do it like that. I mean, the proverbial switch in the basement of Staples Center has been there since the Kobe days, and, you know, it's always been a joke that, when do they turn the switch on? So it's always going to be a big question mark hanging over any team's head when they have to flip the switch, so to speak.
All right, all of baseball had to start talking about their own team and not the Astros now that they're actually playing games. Early returns, if any, on the Dodgers now that they've made the big splashy move for Mookie Betts. Do you like what you see early on?
Yeah, I mean, they won their first game in dominant fashion, hit some balls all over the place. I mean, it's hard to take much from spring training, quite honestly. I think even with Mookie Betts, you know, you look at that and you go, a bust, right? 0-for-2 in his debut. So, I mean, I feel like you win your opener. And what do they say about spring training? The old rule is you don't want to win them all and you don't want to lose them all. So I think the Dodgers are doing okay thus far with regard to how that's all panning out.
Is there any reason to believe the Angels could finally step up in the West?
Well, Joe Maddon obviously gives them a different mindset, a different face, a different... I think that's going to help them, but
sure.
The West is still a tough place to be. So I don't know that they have that. It's not one of those teams that has a ton of talent and then all of a sudden, we got the right manager now. They have some talent, but not a ton of it. So it's still going to be a big chore for them to become a contender.
Pete Fox in L.A., great stuff, buddy. We appreciate it. Have a great week.
You too, thanks.
Local talk plus national headlines from the people who are there. The 2-Minute Drill on the program with Seren Petro on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
All right, the Joe's Kansas City Barbecue burnt end of the hour answer. How many players have hit 500 Major League home runs without a 40-homer season? The answer is one. Eddie Murray, born on this date. His career high was 33.
Didn't we already do that one? Sure.
We talked about it in the break.
We talked about it during the break?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll take that.
Second lowest career high was 42 by Mel Ott. 9 more. Murray was certainly one of a kind in that regard.
Let the record show I nailed it.
You did. Right off the bat.
That one I knew. I knew him, and the debate was there anybody else?
Nobody else within 8.
Wow. That's wild. Pretty impressive. Consistency. That's what it was. We mentioned, by the way, Joe's Kansas City Barbecue. What we are playing for. You can get it tonight. Take it home. Go to joeskc.com. Find the location nearest you, 119th and Strangline, 117th and Row. And the original at 47th and Mission, there are gas pumps. I had some people reaching out to me. They're taking the pumps down. They were just upgrading the pumps.
Ah.
They got to have the gas. That's what it is. That's iconic to Joe's Kansas City. You can go check it out. Tonight, grab some on your way home. We had it. Fight night. Tweeted out a photo of our ribs, pulled pork.
Good
had
stuff.
A great spread for the boxing match. So thanks to the guys and gals at Joe's Kansas City as we did it upright at my house for the fight. But you can get it right now. Go to joeskc.com. Today is the 40th anniversary of the gold medal winning game against Finland for the Miracle on Ice USA Olympic hockey team in 1980. They beat the Russians what would have been 40 years ago, 2 days ago. So Saturday was the 40th anniversary of that. Then they beat Finland 40 years ago today. one of the most iconic sports moments in the history of this country. And at a time that the Cold War was raging, a massive political moment as well. Amateur U.S. hockey players against what were basically, you know, 31, 27, 28-year-old Russians who had been just an absolute dominant force, getting over that and then holding on. I should say, hold on, winning 4-2. They were down. But winning 4-2 over Finland to win the gold, one of the greatest accomplishments in the history of American sports. And one of the guys that was a huge part of that team is Ken Morrow, who played on that team, of course, and then a great NHL career and now continues to work in hockey and lives right here in Kansas City. I had a chance to catch up with him. I asked Ken if he could believe how big and how prevalent that accomplishment is still 40 years later.
Nothing amazes us anymore as a team. You know, I know initially, you know, we thought maybe people will remember it for a few years, maybe 10 years. But, you know, we went through a 10-year anniversary was the first one we celebrated out in Lake Placid. Then we did a 20-year. Then it was a 25 and a 30 and a 35. And the 35-year anniversary was probably the biggest one we had, believe it or not, all those years later. They filled up, I think, Lake Placid Arena. It was sold out. We were up on stage just telling stories. And here we are at 40 years, and it's a sobering number, 40. You know, I've found it's a lot different for me personally, just being more reflective over everything that's happened over 40 years. And I like to think that, you know, what happened in Lake Placid hasn't defined me as a person, but it's certainly played a major role in my life.
I can tell you, I was at my great aunt's house. I remember her couch. I remember the little tassels. She had wonderful taste. She was a wonderful woman and was watching me for whatever reason. I don't know if my mom was out of town or just had an event that night or what was going on, but I was at her house and I remember the coffee table. I remember the lighting. I remember how the lighting was. I remember the television, how it worked. She had one of the first remotes to go through four channels, you know, and we were watching my great aunt and I that game. And I'll never forget that, just everything about that. I don't know why. I can see her fireplace. I haven't been in that house in 20 years, and I can see the fireplace clear as day and how we're watching. And of course, it was tape delayed.
Yes.
We did not get it live. But back then, you didn't have the internet and everything else. I didn't know the outcome of the game, and it was unbelievable. How much I remember that. Do you remember every second of it, every play, every move, or is some of it blended together over the years?
It's blended together. Okay. And it's funny how the movie which came out in 2004 has kind of jogged my memory on some things,
right?
and it's become reality for me on other things, because, you know, we all lose a little bit of our memory. But going back to what you just said, telling your story, to me, that's been the biggest joy of what happened in Lake Placid is that we had an effect on people, and they're still telling me their stories now, and I love hearing every one of them. And I still get mail on a daily basis, and it's the same thing. In the letter, they'll explain, you know, their experience with it. 40 years later, they're still telling me that.
Yeah.
And it's really been the biggest, the most fun for me.
Herb Brooks, you mentioned how he did things as a coach. There's a statement we were talking earlier in the movie. They kind of showcase that he made a statement that, you know, I'm your coach, not your friend. And yes, he lived up to that. But he lived up to that not only and leading up to the game, but even afterwards. He's since passed, but yeah. No one ever really did get close to Herb Brooks amongst you players. Is that right?
Nobody got close. And, you know, I think he told people in confidence that he would, you know, he would have loved to have been able to go in and have a beer. You know, Herb grew up in kind of the rough area of St. Paul, Minnesota, you know, and going out and having a beer with your buddies and everything. That's the kind of guy Herb was, but that's not the way he was as a coach. And, that was true. He made that statement right off the bat.
Why was he so successful with that team?
I say that, you know, I give Herb Brooks full credit to what happened to Lake Placid. We wouldn't have won a gold medal without him. He should go up there, in my mind, with the all-time greats, the Vince Lombardis, the John Woodens, Bill Walsh's. He was that great of a coach. And what made him great? I think there are two things that made him great. He was a visionary. He was 30 years ahead of his time.
Right.
We were doing things, whether it was training, psychologically. We were doing things that nobody else was doing. And we were doing things on the ice that teams and the NHL didn't get to until 30 years later. So
give me an example. What was he doing on the ice that was so far ahead of the game?
Off the ice plyometrics. First time I'd ever heard of it. Never heard of it until probably 10, 15 years later that plyometrics came around. He had us doing that off the ice. On the ice, overspeed training. He used to, talking to the guys, you know, we had 10 players off the Olympic team. Half the team played for Herb at the University of Minnesota, where he had won 3 national championships. So he had great success there. And he was using a lot of these same things at that program. It was almost kind of his proving ground for what he did at Lake Placid. But he would bring a guy in once a week, and he would turn the practice over to him. His name was Jack Blatherwick, part of the U.S. Olympic training staff, I believe, at the time. And he would do overspeed training, which I'd never heard of before or since.
Right.
But we would go out there, and we wouldn't use pucks. We would just go out there, and he would have us do these drills at breakneck speed. Because normally, as an athlete, you'll do a drill, and you'll do it to your comfort level. You might do it at 85%, because if you go 90%, you might fall or on the ice. And so we were doing drills just to get our feet going faster, kind of like running downhill.
Sure.
To get your legs to get going faster than you think they can go, right? We did some overspeed training, you know, just everything that we did, you know, that Herb came up with, the skating, the Herbies that came up in the movie, you know, doing the Herbies after practice. I can tell you I was never in better shape, and I played 10 years in the NHL, never in better shape in my life. It wasn't even close. Than that year with the Olympic team.
How about the guys around you? One of the guys that's immortalized with the tape is Jim Craig with the flag draped over him after the game, the American flag.
Yes.
How instrumental was he? I mean, we know in hockey, you know, the term standing on your head. You know, a goalie can take over a series. We get to the Stanley Cup playoffs, and that's one of the big things. Who's got the hottest goalie? And that can drive a team. How was Jim Craig, and how instrumental was he in your success?
Jim was phenomenal, and you just explained it. He was almost unbeatable, and especially in the big games there, you know, the game against Russia is the one everybody knows, but as Al Michaels has pointed out, we got outshot 39-16 in that game. And you know, as a hockey fan, when you're getting outshot over 2-1, your chances of winning that game aren't very good. And for a goaltender, it's making the save, the big one, you know, not making the routine save, but can you come up with the big save? Jimmy was, when a goaltender plays, I can tell he's a defenseman, when a goaltender plays that well, the confidence exudes out from there. It goes out to the defenseman playing in front of him. You feel you can do more as a defenseman. You're not on your heels. You're on your toes, you know, when a goalie's making saves like that. And so it filtered out to the rest of the team.
All right, that's Ken Morrow, defenseman on that Miracle on Ice hockey team. We'll take a break when we come back. I will talk about the mindset the team had as they entered the Olympics. That's next here in the program.
The program with Soren Petro.
You know, he brings a tremendous level of enthusiasm and intensity to everything he does, even mealtime. You know, he's a fired-up guy.
Weekdays from 2 to 6 on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
You're in the program on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Soren Petro with you. 40th anniversary of the Miracle on Ice is today, or at least the completion of winning the gold medal is today. We had a chance to catch up with Ken Morrow. Lives here in town. Great, great hockey mind. And, of course, member of that Olympic team, now scout, and just a great, great player in the NHL as well. He's one of the guys really went on to a great NHL career. I asked Ken if they felt confident they could win the gold when the big games began, or if that was something that built as they went along through the tournament.
It did gain momentum. I think if you asked every player, our goal, and we talked about it all year long with Herb, was make the medal round. And it may take a minute to kind of explain how the point system worked back then. I know it's different now. There were 12 teams in the Olympics. In the Olympic hockey, they had it divided up into 2 groups of 6. And so you had to finish in the top 2 in your group to make what they called the medal round. And so we knew going in that our two toughest rivals, who were both ranked ahead of us, were Sweden and Czechoslovakia. And we, as it turned out, we played Sweden the first game, Czechoslovakia second game. So our Olympics were basically predicated on those first two games.
Right.
If we'd have lost either one of those teams, we wouldn't have made the medal round. The rest is history, I guess you'd say.
Did you like it? Did Herb Brooks tell you this is exactly what we want? Let's get these two right away? Or was there a feeling like, whoa, couldn't we have like eased into this? You know, put our toe in the water before we go up against what we know are the two teams we've got to beat to get there?
I think we would have loved to have been able to put our toe in the water, but yeah. It wasn't to be. You know, we knew beforehand what the schedule was, and so everything that we did. You know, and I'm sure Herb used that to our advantage. You know, he was a master psychologist, and I can't remember, but I'm sure that he would have said, "Hey, look, you know, we're gonna be on our game right off the bat."
And they were the team to beat. They had won gold in 64, 68, 72, and 76.
Right.
Four-time defending Olympic champions. They were 27-1-1. I know, in those Olympics. So they'd only been beaten once, only tied once, coming through it, and outscored their opponents 175-44.
Right.
So, you know, they were not just winning.
Yeah.
You know, they were dominating everybody. And we touched on it earlier. You guys were all college kids that were playing, but they had been playing in what you would probably call a semi-pro league. Right? They were playing in Russia. Hockey was their full-time job, but they would play for, like, what, company teams or town teams? Or how did it work that they had so much experience?
They actually had
it wasn't league, just their track record. They were older, experienced, veteran players, having played where?
Yeah, they did have a league in Russia, you know, similar to what the NHL would be. It was a smaller league, but they had some what they call elite teams, and then they have some, like, B-level teams and so on. And so they gear up towards all the international tournaments, you know. But they did play an actual, you know, a league series against other teams in Moscow or wherever it might be, St. Petersburg. But as you mentioned, you know, that they were called the Red Army team, which was intimidating in itself.
Right.
You know, the jerseys were red with the hammer and sickle. And it was just an intimidating team all around, you know. Nobody smiled. and they were, they were the Harlem Globetrotters, and everybody else was the Washington Generals, you know.
And when does the intimidation on their face, the look of intimidator on their face, change to fear? At some point, that had to happen. At some point, you know, when you take control of the game, you had to see that change for the Russians.
Yeah, and I
or did it not? Did
at the time I wouldn't have said yes, but now again with the. You know, having been able to look back, you know, in a different perspective now, I do think, you know, maybe partway through the third period, you know, they were so used to turning it on when they needed to, you know, they could almost at will say, okay, here we go, you know, and score three or four goals in the next couple minutes. And I think, you know, halfway through the third period, we got the lead on them. Mike Ruzioni scores with exactly 10 minutes to go. I looked up to the clock and I said, this is going to be the longest 10 minutes of my life, you know, trying to keep these guys off the scoreboard. And so all of a sudden you start seeing, you know, icings, you know, something that they hardly ever did, you know, icing the puck and rushing shots. And, you know, I guess you could probably say yes in their own way. You know, they were probably never in that position. And I think that was the one thing, is that they were never in a position like that where they were trailing in a big game like that and then not pulling their goalie, you know. You know, we ended up tying the game against Sweden by pulling our goalie. We were down 2-1. Herb pulls the goalie, and Bill Baker scores with 20-some seconds to go to tie that game. Otherwise, we're not playing in the medal round.
Right.
And so... they're down, the Russians are down by a goal. It gets down into the last 2 minutes, and they don't pull their goalie because they never had to.
Mike Ruzioni is always remembered. He's the guy that jumped on the point. He's the guy who's only supposed to get the medal to represent the team, and he waves everybody up onto the stand. That's the memory that everybody has of him. And, of course, scoring the goal, you mentioned, to take the lead against the Russians. Why was he the captain? What made him the captain?
He was, we had two kind of veteran guys, if you want to say, Mike and Buzz Schneider. They were both 25 years old at the time. And Mike had just kind of been around. He had been playing some pro hockey, still retained his amateur status, but he was playing in the IHL at the time. He was a great, from Boston. He just had that great personality, you know, that one guy that you could see was a leader. And I don't know what went on behind the scenes. You know, a lot of times coaches like to kind of name their own captain or, you know, make sure that guy gets named. But for Mike, I think the players just, you know, rallied around him, the veteran experience that he brought, and he was the right guy at the right time.
After that game, it's not over. And you want to talk about a letdown situation, yeah. You know. People try to figure out what teams are going to be. You mentioned coming flat for the opening. Who could possibly come flat for the opening game of the Olympics? But half empty building. The thing hadn't even really started yet.
Yes.
Yet you're having to play in that opening game. Talk about coming down off what was, this is the team. You'd just beaten the team, and now you got to go out and play Finland, and you get down to Finland. What was the mindset going into that game 2 days later?
Herb did his greatest coaching job Saturday morning. We played Russia on Friday evening, and here, as you said, you know, this, I think our average age was 21 years old, you know, so we were by far the youngest team at that tournament. And, you know, we're all walking into practice the next day, and all the state policemen that were around, and everybody's asking us for our autographs. I'd never signed an autograph in my life, right? And people are, and Herb saw this, and he put the hammer down right away. If you ask the guys, he put us through one of our hardest practices that we had been through all year that morning, trying to get that out of our head. Hey, you guys haven't won anything.
Right.
And how disappointing would it have been, to have, you know, won this monumental game on Friday and then to have lost on Sunday. And we were playing a very, very good Finland team. So mm-hmm. It was not, you know, a team that, it was probably a team that we, you know, before the Olympics, you would have said that they were the favorites to win that game. And here we go from Herb Brooks giving his probably the greatest motivational speech, which I still get people want me to come in and give Herb's speech before games. The greatest motivational speech before the Russian game. You were born to be a player. You were meant to be here. This is your moment. Now let's go out there and take it. To his speech, you know, before the Finland game was, you guys lose this game and you'll take it to your graves. And it was sobering, and it was true. And here we are, as we were in 5 of the 7 games, we're down 2-1 going into the third period.
And was there panic or was there confidence?
There wasn't panic. And you know, I've heard this story from Craig Patrick recently, who was, you know, Herb was our common enemy, and Herb was the good cop, you know, and Craig was instrumental in what happened and keeping the guys on board and everything. And Craig tells the story. I don't remember this, but he said, we're down 2-1. We're in the locker room. Craig says Herb came up to him out in the hallway and says, you got to go in and talk to him. I've lost the team. You know, I've lost them. You got to go in there and say something. So Craig Patrick, very, very quiet guy. He says he turned around. He says he walked into the locker room to say something. And he said one word came out of his mouth, and he said two guys jumped up. I think it was O'Callaghan and Mark Johnson, said, Craig, get out of here. There's no way we're losing to this team. And everybody started jumping up and down and screaming and hollering and everything. And Craig says, I waited a couple minutes. I turned around, went out. Herb says, how'd it go? He says, yeah, I think it went well.
And you mentioned it. If you don't win that game, it's – you know, your life is Ken Murrow, the Olympian, not part of the Miracle on Ice, not part of the greatest upset in history. It really was. And, I mentioned that to somebody the other day when I was telling them that you were coming in. And they said, oh, yeah, that gold medal game against the Russians. I said, yeah, that wasn't the game.
Right.
Finland was the gold medal game. You know, they had to go through the Russians to get there.
Yes.
But that wasn't it. And so many people forget that. And I think that is, you know, like you said, maybe the greatest thing you guys accomplished to get back up and beat what was, again, a team that was favored against you, a team that was older,
more experienced,
and do it again when you've already slayed the giant.
Yes.
It's like David slaying Goliath. And, oh, by the way, here's a guy who's 2 inches shorter. You got to take him down, too.
Yeah. Or maybe a foot shorter. I don't want to diminish how good the Russian team was, but there was still a really big guy that you had to slay.
You're absolutely right, and I think Jack O'Callaghan described it best. He said that they opened the door for the third period, and he says we just steamrolled them. And if you have a film or if you're able to watch the actual footage of the third period of the Finland game, we scored three goals, and we probably could have scored another three or four. Yeah. And it was just like we weren't going to be denied. Yeah. And that might be our proudest moment as a team.
And a litany of proud moments. Yes. Ken Morrow there from the Miracle on Ice team, and one of the best players on that team, lives here in Kansas City. Peach of a guy.
Absolutely.
Gold medal winning guy.
Four-time Stanley Cup
winner.
Four-time
Stanley Cup winner. Gold medal, which doesn't have, there aren't many U.S. Hockey players that have a gold medal.
No.
He's got one, and it's the, maybe the biggest gold medal this country's ever won. Certainly in a team sport.
Yep.
You know?
There used to be an electronic store in Independence called, I think it was called Cohen. That's where I watched that. Everyone was gathered around the TV section of this electronics store watching that game. And when they won, when they had the big goal, everyone, when that's when they won, the place just, I've never seen an electronics store go up for grabs.
No, just unbelievable.
Singular moment in history.
The moment in history it was. All right, you're listening to Sports Radio 810 WHB Kansas City. Ian Kennedy, Royals closer, next here on the program.
It's the Jazz End of the Hour Question on the Half Shell. Sponsored by Jazz, a Louisiana kitchen.
Laissez le bon temps rouler.
Right before the NHL began allowing players in the Olympics, how many players won an Olympic gold medal and multiple Stanley Cup titles? Brought to you by Jazz, a Louisiana kitchen.